too many different things. My CV was a bit of a mess, a bit of a mishmash of lots of different things. And it's been really nice over the past year to be like, actually, I have one job, and then all the other bits I want to do, mm-hmm. I'm doing other bits because I want to rather than need to.
Yeah.
Which is really nice to kind of be in that. So you've caught me in a sort of totally different headspace than I would have been like a year ago or 18 months ago.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome back, Melanin Fam. I'm your co-host, Natalia.
And Renisha.
And we're back with another great episode. Today's topic is all about taking up space as a woman of color, and we have the privilege of sitting down with a remarkable guest whose journey encompasses the realm of music, education, research, and activism. Please welcome Dr. Diljeet.
Yay! Thank you so much for coming onto our podcast. We're super excited about this. I'm more excited because I love music, and I have a little tidbit to add. Just, you know, whoop whoop to me. I was in the marching band back in the States. Now, did I play an instrument? No. But I did play the violin in elementary school, so aww. I can play a few notes for you. Yay. Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
That's when I played the violin.
Yay! It got me as far as twinkle, twinkle, little star, and I did really well.
Yay! We can do a little duet. Yay!
Oh, I love that. Like, all I remember is doing those recorders in school.
Yes.
Yeah, that's about as far as I can bring this in. Like, I was trying to learn the ukulele. Did not work out.
Yeah. I thank my parents for that because I think they put me into literally everything. Like, try this. Okay. Bombard it. But yeah, I feel proud about that. But how are we feeling today?
Good. Yeah. Nice to get out the house on a Saturday morning. And
Yeah. On a Glasgow, like, typically.
Dark.
We're looking outside right now. Yeah. And it's like, oh! If you've been to Scotland, It's great.
But it's not raining today, so that means it's a good day.
It's a good day. The hair is not fully working, but it's still in some type of mess.
I feel like we need to, like, knock on some wood. Because now I feel like it's going to rain later today.
Let's not put that energy into the world. You hear us, Scotland?
No.
Keep it dry. Well, for a lot of our, well, actually for me even as well, I came across your name through Pass the Mic, and I was like looking through that website and I was like, oh, this sounds amazing. Like, this person's bio is amazing. Like, this is definitely something that I don't know a lot about in Scotland as far as like music and then education. And then like, you just had such a wide range of things that you were doing. And then I started following you, and then we had recently gone to Pitch Scotland.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was amazing.
That was amazing.
The different artists that were there. I think there's one group, I'm hoping I'm right, like, I think his name is Superman.
Yes.
And he was amazing, and we met them. I know he also had, like, another gig, like, kind of, like, a couple months back at the Mono Club, which I miss. I'm really sad I missed that. But, like, meeting him and then all the other artists out there, I was just like, this is so great for Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
And just bringing the diverse crowd and the diverse music as well, because we got a little bit of everything, which I wasn't expecting, but I enjoyed myself very much. Yeah,
definitely. And I kept seeing your name pop up everywhere, and I was just like, I need to meet this person. She's in everything that you do. I'm like, this is amazing. I never knew this existed in Scotland. Yeah. So, I mean, I've done a little bit of research, but could you let our audience know, like, what it is that you do?
Yeah, sure. So I guess, yeah, lots of things. I have fingers in many pies. Seem to get around a bit. So I'm a musician, I guess, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. I guess making music or kind of being around the music industry and music education is kind of the current that runs throughout everything that I do. So I've been playing music, I guess, seriously in terms of studying or playing for like 20 years, I guess. Although it's always been a massive part of my life, even in primary school, if I think about what I enjoyed most, it was like I was there to sing and, you know, play and learn. That was my big focus. And then kind of since, I guess, growing up, becoming an adult and thinking more about what I wanted to do, I've always had a really strong interest in education. So I went through various kind of different possibilities of that, and then decided I wanted to work in higher education. So I've done that for a number of years, lecturing kind of all around the Central Belt, and do bits of guest lecturing around the UK. Mostly in music, but I've dabbled in the odd guest lecture for like museum studies or kind of wider creative industry stuff, just kind of through random jobs that I was doing at that point in time. Mm-hmm. I teach in higher education still, and that's where I also picked up my love of research. So I'm also a researcher. I have done a PhD and the doctor, which was an amazing opportunity to have, and I get really kind of nerdy and excited about research methods and data. I think that's something in terms of doing my kind of activism work, I've always been very much about how do we evidence this? How do we evidence the issues, especially when we know we have to work harder to prove what that issue is? So that's kind of how that all ties in together. And I've always been really interested in kind of the activism related to kind of inequalities in music and music education.
Yeah.
That's where that comes in. And so a lot of my work's kind of danced around the intersections of all those and overlaps of all those things. I now work full-time for the Musicians Union, which is a trade union for musicians in the UK. We have over 34,500 members, I think, now.
Wow.
Definitely
wow.
Over 34,000. And the union's been around for like 130 years, I think, something like that. It's, and that's gone through its own kind of journey of things. But I've been involved in the union as an activist. I suppose that was the kind of first formal activism I did, mm-hmm. was joining union committee when I was about 24. It'll be 10 years this year, actually, since I joined the regional committee. And then I joined the executive committee. I did some of the EDI committee. And then I got this job that I have now, which is an equality, diversity and inclusion officer, which is amazing because it feels like it was the job brings together lots of things that I've been doing the whole time, bringing in my perspective as a musician, as a member, as someone who's been a trade union activist, mm-hmm. but then doing the equalities work and bringing my kind of academic knowledge and research skills into that as well. Mm-hmm. And then kind of alongside all of that, musically, where I kind of sit now, so I'm a flute player by training. So I picked up the flute when I was about 12 in school and used to play, I guess, normal classical repertoire. Mm. So lots of historical, mm-hmm. you know, repertoire, composers who are not alive anymore, typically white European men. Mm-hmm. Didn't really bat an eyelid at that for a really, really, really long time. Yeah, I guess. And then once I did, I kind of couldn't look, you kind of, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. And also just found classical music just wasn't the space for me.
Yeah.
Mm. And apart from, well, there's little pockets of it that are, I guess, more like led by POC, for mm-hmm. example, that have felt more welcoming. But my practice now, my creative practice, is much more about improvisation, going with the flow, like living with the imperfection of it all, which is funny because we were just talking about that when we came in this morning of like, I feel like that's like an embodiment of me trying to learn how to go with the flow.
Yeah.
And the two kind of help each other out. The more mm-hmm. I'm kind of like, do you know what? It's fine with whatever this is today is what it is.
That's me.
And so that's been really amazing. And I'm gigging a lot more now as well. And it's amazing not freelancing anymore. When I was freelancing, I've been everything from like a museum's project coordinator to research consultant, theatre producer, session musician, musical director. Like I've done too many different things. My CV was a bit of a mishmash of lots of different things. And it's been really nice over the past year to be like, actually, I have one job, and then all the other bits I want to do, mm-hmm. I'm doing other bits because I want to rather than need to.
Yeah.
Which is really nice to kind of be in that. So you caught me in a sort of totally different headspace than I would have been like a year ago or 18 months ago.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I feel like you were mentioning your different freelance and how the CV is a bit of a mess, and I can totally relate to that because in a sense I feel like where we're at now, I'm trying to get all these like different experience, but also put myself out there. Mm. How did you yourself as a freelancer kind of pick the jobs or market yourself to these people?
Oh, that's a really good one. Picking the jobs. I don't know. Maybe I'll let them pick me. The reason my CV has so many different tangents in it is because it was kind of, I guess that's part of the freelance hustle, mm-hmm. where sometimes you feel like you need to take on whatever your way,
yep.
even if it's not necessarily what you want to focus on or where you think you actually even have the right knowledge or skill set. It's
exactly.
like someone is willing to pay me to do this, mm-hmm. so I'm going to give it a go. And I've always been open with people when they've done that.
Yeah.
You know, when I've been like, so I actually don't work in this sector, but if you want to take a chance, fine. Mm. And I've been really fortunate to kind of learn new things through that. But I'm definitely, it's taken me a long time to learn how to be selective because of that sort of hustle culture mentality.
Yeah.
I think now, because I don't have to hustle, which is very, very, like, an amazing privilege, really fortunate. Mm. I guess it's more thinking about who I want to be working with and what the values are behind the work. I guess that's something as a woman of colour feels really important. I've been in situations where, you know, you become the sort of token EDI person or the token bit of kind of representation. Especially in some facets of music, it can be really white. So having been through those experiences of being a sort of poster girl or tokenistic representation and being able to now identify that, I think that's the biggest thing for me when it comes to choosing what work I do, is going, right, why are they asking me to do this? Where is this coming from?
Yeah.
And is it ultimately going to be a safe and fulfilling thing for me to do? So what's the benefit to me as opposed to what's the benefit to them? Because it cannot anymore be purely financial for me. And that's been, again, that's the privilege of not being full-time freelance now, is that I can not be motivated by the pay and do it because I want to, which is amazingly lucky.
I think that's such a cool space to be in as well. And I think, going back on everything you just said, it is that mindset change, right? Before it's like, oh, I want to do all this because people are paying me. And I was like, yeah, why not? And then now you're in a space where it's like you're almost recognizing that because of all this, that you're a real commodity to anybody that were to take you on. Like, you have so many different perspectives in different ways. So it's really nice to see that there was that transition. Yeah. And now you're in a space where you're like, no, I'm going into this interview, I'm demanding my worth, because there's no way you're going to get somebody that's done music education, you know, data analysis. Yeah. And add all that up. Like, I think that's so cool. And I also think, like, as well, it gives me a big or a different perspective of, like, how to frame my own journey, which I like, because I'm just so used to hearing, like, oh, well, you're supposed to stick to this one thing and then work your way up. And it's just, that's not how my brain works.
I like to think of it as kind of almost like the magic little Venn diagram, where you sit in the middle and you have all these unique things that make your knowledge set and I guess it's also the kind of intersections of the kind of experiences you've had, like the things you've done and sought out, but then also the lived stuff, all that lived experience, and that it creates this sort of perfect little, you know, and every now and then those perfect opportunities come up where you fit everything, and that's almost kind of made for you, which is amazing.
For me, I have a question in a sense of, because I'm as you're speaking and how you're saying, with all these different backgrounds and just taking on different projects, as we said, I know I'm currently doing that, and the reason why I think I'm doing this right is A, to gain all these experiences and have all that under my belt, B, to help network and put myself out there so people know that I am, you know, out here and I could do this work. It also helps me understand things that I thought I did want to do. After doing it, no, I don't want to do that anymore. But it's also one of those, is like, if there becomes a time limit for you, right, like, understand there is a bit of privilege for some who doesn't have the necessary thought of, like, with their visa or any kind of like that. But if someone with a visa who has a limited time and, again, wants to have all this under their belt, and so yes, taking up all this freelance work may seem like, yes, I should know my worth, yes, I should, you know, not take on projects just to take on projects, but at the same time, it seems that's the only way that I can possibly get to where I want. Now, I'm not saying that that's the right answer, but that's just like the mindset. So how would you, like, help someone, or not help, or give a bit of advice in navigating through that?
I mean, I think you've brought up some really important things here in terms of, like, networking. So I was, like, at the same time that I was building this kind of very varied freelance portfolio, I was also doing my PhD. So I was going to conferences all the time. I was going to, like, practice conferences, kind of straight academic conferences. I was going to, like, workshops in the fields I was researching, like, kind of vocational conferences as well as like kind of academic ones, like training courses for teachers, that sort of things. Mm-hmm. And the networking part of it was totally invaluable, and it did take me on some of those tangents. Okay. And I think for me, if I think of it as a journey over kind of, I would have started freelancing in like 2012, I think. Okay. I started freelancing. So it's been like over a decade. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it was the journey of, okay, I'm doing this because I want to seek out all these experiences and because I want to just soak it all in, mm-hmm. build all the connections. There came a point where I realized I'd kind of done that. I had the connections, my name was out, and therefore I could take the foot off the gas on that mm-hmm. one. But also I think it's exactly what you say. It's about learning, of going, it's actually, you know, but I think for me, where I kind of realized I fell into a trap of it was that I didn't know how to say no. And I think that's the biggest thing. I think for anyone doing it is absolutely go out, explore, soak it all in. But I think for me, it was being mindful of burnout, being mm-hmm. mindful of not being able to say no, mm-hmm. and then being able to kind of increase, like, for example, my fee or what I was needing from it.
Yeah.
Or my working, even if not fee, but, you know, the working conditions. Mm-hmm. What are the criteria? What are the things I need so that this isn't becoming more stress than it's worth?
Mm.
I think that was the thing that I noticed over time, was needing to have those conversations about how much I was being paid or how I was being paid or what the expectation was for that pay.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes when we're freelancers, we can often push ourselves to go over and above because we want to build a relationship.
Yeah.
And that's fine to an extent at the start when you're trying to make a good impression, I think. And also just, if that's what you've got capacity for, etc. Mm-hmm. But I think when it becomes an expectation
mm-hmm.
that you're going to go over and above when it's not being recognized or valued, I think that's where it becomes a problem, because then ultimately it's about us being able to then be sustainable.
Yeah.
And how we work. So it's yeah. being able to, I guess, just being reflective through the whole thing and mm-hmm. just keeping in check and going, like, is this what I want? You know, I went through a period where I went, do I want to be self-employed? Do I want to start looking for jobs? This is before the job I've got now even came up. I was like, well, do I want to be full-time in higher education? Do I want to be full-time freelance? Do I want this middle ground where I'm a bit of both?
Mm.
And actually really having to interrogate what, you know, and making lists, making all my pros and cons lists of, like, what do I actually want from this?
Yeah.
So that I could actually make those decisions.
Yeah, that's a tricky one, and I definitely feel you on that one. It's also one of those, I'm curious, did you at those time have any support in a sense of, like, taking on mentoring or life coach or therapy even? Did
yeah.
those come about and help?
Yeah, so I've definitely done, like, formal mentoring, which was amazing, and that's particularly, I think, around my musical work.
Mm-hmm.
That's really helped me kind of streamline what I wanted to do musically. Okay. I've also actually worked a little bit as a coach.
Oh, really?
I can see that. I get that vibe.
And that was for, that was at the conservatoire here in Glasgow for young people who are interested in pursuing the arts and higher education. But actually the training for that then meant we were doing coaching sessions with other the other coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Where we'd coach each other a little bit in the training. And so mm-hmm. it's just been interesting in terms of being able to then have those questions and try and think through things
mm-hmm.
as if a coach was asking me these things, and, you know, being intentional about goal setting and mm. All of those things. I think that's massively important. And yeah, things like therapy mm. Have been, you know, I think they're massive in terms of learning about yourself and prioritizing things.
Yeah.
And I think for me, a big part of that's also about understanding the whole self
mm.
and not just looking at it through a work lens or not just looking at it through a study lens, like, or a personal lens, like trying to see it as a whole cool. picture.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was really important in terms of, like, yeah, aligning, like, my values with my work and
yeah.
things like that.
Yeah, I like that idea of, like, a whole self. And, like, you're saying it, and also in my head I'm thinking, like, how do I do that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like everything you're yeah. saying, I'm trying to reflect on my own yeah. like personal things, and mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, how can I have that same mindset?
Yeah.
And I know it takes time.
Yeah, the whole self thing was interesting. I came across a campaign by Mental Health First Aid England.
Oh.
It's called the Whole Self Campaign, and the premise of it is that people should be able to, like, go to work and be their whole selves.
Yes.
Because when you don't, you then start boxing parts of yourself off, mm-hmm. and that has a negative impact on your mental health and well-being,
mm-hmm.
Which massively resonated with me, because I was like, it was the same time that I was realizing how much I had been trying to conform and fit in, present myself in certain ways, realizing kind of the negative aspects of, like, assimilation culture that mm-hmm. I've been carrying my whole life
mm-hmm.
growing up in Scotland, and just kind of, and I noticed, I think it was when I noticed it creeping in higher education in terms of what I was going to be researching and how, and the rules of that, and who gets to research what, that I kind of really started interrogating this idea that, well, why do I need to have gone and studied South Asian history to talk about partition and colonialism in India? I know this stuff because my family have lived it, and the more I delve into family history, the more I'm learning about it, or I'm learning about it through my Twitter contacts who are talking about these things. I don't need to necessarily have had a scholarly background to be able to study this. And I think that's something interesting, because had I been thinking about this stuff 10 years earlier, it would have shaped what I did after school in a different way. But sometimes, you know, we don't learn till later, and you know, I was halfway through a PhD being like, oh, colonialism. Actually, I was at that point, it was like, oh, I've never really thought about this. Hold on, you know, why are you know, all but one of people I spoke to in my PhD white? You know, why was that normal to me? That was the question I started. I was like, why was that normal to me? And also then, where do I fit in this? And why are there not more people who look like me in this space? And I think that was where I started realizing about the idea that I hadn't been bringing my whole self. And also, therapy's good for that one. You're like, oh wait, no, I'm compartmentalizing. It's using up a lot of energy. Oh, okay. You know?
Me too. Yeah. Got it. Thank you. Just needed that reassurance, but okay, cool.
I love as well that you said, like, when you were in the spaces and you were using like lived experience and that story telling and sharing to gain knowledge. Because I feel like I also recently, like, I mean, I've always known, and like, there's always been a joke in my family, like, oh, don't trust a white person. Like, there's like always, you always have that a little bit. And I just never really thought why that was such a common thing. And like recently, I say recently, like 2 years ago, after I did my undergrad and then moving different places, I was introduced more into like activism and stuff, and, you know, the decolonized things start popping up, and I was like, what does this mean? Like, I don't know really fully what this is or like how to gauge that. And then I even remember when I was doing my master's, almost a year and a half ago. Oh my God, it's been that long. And I remember like thinking and reading these stories, and I'm like, well, who's writing these books? Like, even just reading this, I realize it's problematic, because it's like, you're kind of dictating how people are seeing a whole group of people, but you have no connection to that.
Yeah.
And I think like we feed in that into a society, and then like that internalizes to us and how we deem ourselves acceptable in spaces, but also makes us so unaware, but also aware of microaggressions that happen. And I remember when I was doing my master's here and I was in class, and, you know, everybody always says, oh, the loud American, whatever, right? And I remember my professor even saying, like, you're going to have a difficult time in British politics here. And I was just like, and I'm the only person of color. I was the only international student in my cohort. And it was one of those things where I was doing public policy. And I was like, what? Like, are you saying that to me as in, like, I can't do it? Are you saying that into me as, like, that's not the space that I would fit in? And I'm thinking, like, would you say that if I was, like, a white American student that was speaking out? And I was like, you wouldn't, because I've seen who your politicians are. Like, there's no major difference. But I think as well, being aware, like you were saying, of your whole self in that space, I didn't feel comfortable bringing my whole self in.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like being in the spaces that you're in here in Scotland, and you were saying like assimilation culture, do you find that you often still kind of like have those safeguards, or when you...
Yeah, 100%. And I think for me, that's where finding the spaces where I can be my whole self become the aspirational spaces. And you know when you found them. You really do know. And I also think part of the journey for me has been about being able to go into those spaces, or go into spaces I have inhabited, and just be like, hey, this is me, by the way. And it's people who've maybe, you know, circles I've been in for 5 years. You know, I went and did a keynote at the International Centre for Community Music at York St John a couple of years back. And I've been around the centre for most, you know, pretty much all the way through my PhD. And it was massively like amazing to get to go and keynote. But I talked about this idea of the whole self. I talk so much in my work about positionalities. That was what they wanted me to talk about in the keynote, because it was the theme of the journal we're going to be co-editing. And I was like, well, actually, at this point in time, I feel like everything's so up in the air. I've opened so many kind of boxes of stuff that needs unpacked mm-hmm. in my own journey, that how can I talk about my positionalities if I don't know where I am, mm-hmm. if I'm still unpacking what the whole self is, then how can I truly talk about my positionalities? Mm-hmm. And then not just talk about it, but how can I do work without fully understanding my like where I'm situated within it?
Mm-hmm.
And that was amazing to actually be in a space where people have met me before and have seen me be my kind of, I guess, a former version of myself, one mm-hmm. that was playing a game, or and the game being assimilation, right?
Yeah.
But being in that space and actually just going in and taking the mask off and being like, hey, I'm going to talk about this stuff,
mm-hmm.
And be open about where my head's at and about, you know, my thoughts on mental health and things like that, and actually just go with it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, go with the flow, which has been, but that's all been part of a really kind of integrated journey
mm.
of, as soon as I started unboxing that stuff and unpacking that stuff and decompartmentalizing, it's had a knock-on impact. But there are definitely still spaces. I think the unpacking has taught me to recognize when I feel the little spidey senses going, you need to be careful here. That's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with the freelance thing of knowing what are the spaces where I'm benefiting from this
yeah.
in the way I need to or want to be. It's, you notice it. Our bodies tell us.
Yeah. I feel like, funny enough, you said earlier about feeling safe. And I'm not gonna lie, I never thought about that word when, you know, picking certain jobs or doing certain things, or like we've been saying, being in a space that's just predominantly white. Because being in a predominantly white space, this may sound bad, but seems normal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't really think, I'm already have these like expectations of, oh, they may think of me a certain type of way, but the actual, my safe being in his presence, and how, like you said, the token person of color there, it's like, I don't know. And again, this may be like the American in me, in a sense of like, I feel less safe if there wasn't. That sounds really bad, but I think, yeah, having the mindset of like where those safe spaces are mm-hmm. for myself, I think it's important. It's something I need to like really, really think about.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. For me, it was totally normal to be the only person in a room.
Mm-hmm.
For 25 years, I didn't question it.
Hmm.
Because it was like, well, looking at the Scottish census, we make up X percent of the population, and then I'm in music. So, you know, and it was just totally, totally normalized
mm-hmm.
for that to be the case. But I think as well, it's also separating out. And I think this is something where, again, because when we try and have those conversations, then white fragility kicks in and goes, but we're not causing you danger. It's not about that. It's about structural
mm-hmm.
unsafety, structural dangers,
mm-hmm.
More than, you know, I mean, obviously there are still like the kind of more direct individual
mm-hmm.
risks, but a lot of it is more to do with the structural stuff
mm-hmm.
of understanding that, you, whether that's, and it, safety for me is such a broad thing. It's like, does that mean you're gonna have to work harder? Does that mean that if you've got an issue, you have to evidence it more?
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that people are gonna assume certain things about you or about what you do or your experience?
Mm-hmm.
And again, that becomes such an intersectional thing around gender as well.
Yeah.
And so for me, like, safety's become, especially in parts of the music industry, it can be on so many different fronts. I felt it from an age perspective
mm-hmm.
Over the years. You know, even within the union, that I definitely kind of experienced bits of people kind of having assumptions about me or my life or my work or my energy levels based on my age. Oh. Why are you tired? You're so young. Ah. Like, well, have you seen my diary?
Right.
This is me in like peak freelance, peak freelance hustle. Have you seen my diary?
Right.
Mister sitting there with your cushy mortgage.
Right.
Like, yeah, right.
Oh my God.
You know, with your pensions and everything.
Oh God.
So it's that sort of understanding of what is it, what does safety actually mean? Because we think of it in a sort of quite straightforward way of like, am I in danger, and we think immediate danger,
mm-hmm.
but actually it's about, well, is this damaging me?
Yeah.
Is this making me feel less confident? Is this, am I having to go out of my way to do things a certain way to be heard or seen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is my work being validated? That's safety.
Yeah.
Mm.
I love that you bring up the topic of like the intersectionality and also being a woman, right, in these sectors. And my question was like, how do you see the intersectionality of being a woman of color influencing your experiences and opportunities in the art industry?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think in terms of opportunities, it's been really interesting. And Scotland over the past decade has been really interesting because, I mean, you said you came across me through Pass the Mic. Mm-hmm. There you go. There's an example of where women of colour have come together.
Yeah.
To make great things happen. And so we're starting to see, you know, I think in some ways the collectiveness of that, the coming together, the community, the supporting each other actually shapes some of the things that come our way. But then I think in terms of the other kind of bits of work I've kind of gone into, it's really made me think about, and again, I had to notice that maybe there weren't that many women or that there weren't any POC or there weren't any women of colour. But then noticing and going, right, how am I going to change the space? You know, and I think I very quickly saw my role as being to change the space. And so it's had a really direct influence when I'm, you know, even with the work I do now. And it's so many different things. It's even like the fact that I'm still a member of the union. So when I talk to other members and I tell them, oh yeah, I play this. And then they're like sharing their Spotify links with me or their like website being like, oh, here's my music, send me yours. And it becomes like, you know, a totally different interaction because they see me. There's a relatability that comes with that. But also it's mutual because I want to know about their projects and then I want to be like, oh, do I know someone that they should connect with? And, you know, wanting to, that's bring always been really central. And I think that comes from also looking at and understanding things like how matriarchal communities work. And I think, that, again, it's this idea of drawing on those kind of strengths of femininities, of being emotional, using my emotional intuition and intelligence, creating community, not buying into competitive capitalist stuff. And, you know, that for me is another way in which those intersections come in the work is how do I disrupt? Because that's the thing. We're working in these situations that are built by white men, built by capitalism, and built on competitiveness. So for me, it's like, well, actually, can we just do, you know, how do I dismantle that in different ways through the work? And that feels really central to my positioning as a brown woman in those spaces, because my existence is hopefully disrupting something. Not on its own, but my existence and then me going, hey, but have you thought about this?
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that you said that your existence is disrupting something, because I feel like, I don't know. I really like that, because I think that's oftentimes, if I'm thinking about how to create spaces, but you're right, it is about dismantling and making those spaces, like shaking them up, making them a little bit uncomfortable to recognize so they can almost be empathetic to what you're constantly feeling and bringing that to the light.
Yeah. And I think also, like, I mean, I feel like I've been in so many rooms where, you know, it's like a room full of white men and I'd be like, so we're going to talk about gender and race or even one or the other. And they just kind of, you just watch everyone get really uncomfortable, which is good. Do they not think we've not felt uncomfortable trying to navigate these spaces our whole lives? So it's like, yeah, you can deal with a bit of discomfort because if you haven't thought about this stuff already, then that shows you that you've got something missing in your perspective.
Yeah.
If you haven't been considering this.
You're not including me already in whatever data project that you're working on, and that's already a problem.
And it's even so far as, you know, whether I even need to say it out loud or whether I'm just going into the room and then just asking difficult questions because my perspective will differ. You know, and that, I mean, even when I first joined the union committees and I'd go in and I was the youngest one there, I was a student, and so I would go in and talk about that and they go, the older guys would get, you know, a bit kind of again, because they didn't understand it. Yes, but can you not do this? Or you know, this is for people who can pay full membership and all these things. And, you know, obviously things have changed massively in the past decade, but
yeah,
it was really interesting being like, actually me being a young early career musician who's maybe not earning that much from music is disrupting the conversation here, because I keep saying, yeah, but what about the low earners? What about the students? You know, and so it's interesting. There are so many different things that people always ask me about, you know, oh, I don't know if I should join the committee because I don't really know what I'll have to contribute. And I was like, I was 24. I didn't think I had anything. Someone told me you should join the committee. Mm-hmm. And then I realized when I got there, even if I didn't have all this, you know, I hadn't been in the industry for 20 years, I didn't have all this playing experience or work experience or union experience, but the fact that I didn't meant I asked different questions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I critiqued the thing in a whole different way than everyone else who was already in the room. And that made it a valuable perspective. But I wouldn't have thought that going in.
Yeah. I love that. And I think, I feel like I'll probably replay that in my head. Anytime I'm in like a scenario where I'm like, ooh, should I join this or not? Yeah. Or ooh, should I do this or not? Like, what would I even bring to it? And I think just remembering what you said, I think is so powerful in itself.
Because I think so much of that kind of idea of like the question of what am I going to be contributing here? Mm-hmm. So much of that is driven by looking at who's already there and going, yeah, but I don't do all these other things they do. Mm-hmm. But actually the fact that you're doing something different or in a different way is the value that you're bringing, you know, from the get-go, that is something that you're bringing to the table that's new.
I love that. And also, I mean, just listening to you talk and I'm thinking in the back of my head, I was like, that's one of my favorite things in the world to do is to sit in a room and make white people uncomfortable. Like, I'm always like, let's have this tough conversation. Like, there's so much happening in the news. There's so much, like, I want to know your perspective and why you think that way, just because that's how I am anyway. But also, I feel like it's the part of that to me is also that accountability for what you're thinking and how. And if you're so just used to talking to the same people in your own circle, you're never going to break out of that.
So I'm just going to go back to your website a little bit, which you have an amazing website. I love the colors that you have. Mm-hmm. But you have an article on there that you wrote called Reflection on My Identity, which, great read. Really related to a lot of things in there. But you asked a certain question in there, and I'm curious if it's still the same answer for you. You asked, when we look at what seems to be a good example of diversity, is it embracing that diversity, or are people conforming to dominant culture norms to get to it?
So that's interesting. I love like things I wrote years ago coming back to not haunt me, but it's interesting though, because when I wrote that, I probably wasn't even thinking about things like the whole self. Okay. I was definitely thinking about assimilation. Mm-hmm. But actually like this, I guess the layers of it have evolved so much in the sense of, at that point in time, I was thinking, well, are people assimilating?
Yeah.
That was kind of the end of it. Mm. Whereas now I'm like, well, actually it's about, I often talk about the idea that we shouldn't just be surviving. We should be able to thrive in an environment.
Mm. Oh, I love that.
And I think for me, that's framed, that whole self plays into that so much, because if you're not being your whole self, then you're surviving. Mm-hmm. When you can be your whole self, that's when you can start to thrive. Mm-hmm. But properly. And so I think for me, it's still a question I ask often when I see projects, you know, even in my day-to-day work now, we'll get people coming to us saying, oh, we want to do this EDI initiative, and can you give us some advice on that? Mm-hmm. And so my question to them will always be, what is the systemic change here? Mm. Are you just doing something that's, you know, about making things visibly more representative and diverse? Or are you actually fundamentally changing how you operate so that it organically becomes more diverse over time? Mm-hmm. We will always play the long game over quick fixes, because that is the only way things actually change. Anything that's seen as a short-term kind of quick fix is likely to be on its surface tokenistic.
Yeah.
Unless there's some kind of, this is, you know, a disruption to how people are recruiting or assessing, making decisions, promotion structures, whatever that is, even like pay and remuneration, working conditions. Unless that stuff is changing, then it's not going to have a deep impact.
Yeah. Mm.
Because if you're not going to make sure that those who've been historically excluded are actually being able to make it sustainable and to feel that they are welcomed and safe and can speak openly, then they're not going to stay. Mm-hmm. And I think also, again, I think, yeah, that's interesting in terms of a... this hasn't ever actually happened. This is more my brain speculating.
Yeah.
But the idea that, and it's more maybe from my own experiences in different sectors of working where I've been made to feel like I should be grateful for opportunities. And especially when they were like the most tokenistic. I was like, hold on, you want me to represent you when I've been a precariously employed short-term person who's not embedded in this institution, but fine, you want to send me to like some other external thing and you want me to feel like I should be grateful for that when it's not creating anything meaningful for him. Well, I got some new contacts out of it and went into that space and went, yeah. It was an EDI forum, so I went into that space and went, hey, I'm a tokenistic rep. So that was interesting because I got loads of support there. They were like, yeah, that's not good. But in terms of the institution I was at, they definitely made me feel like I should be grateful for that opportunity. Yeah, it makes me think about what, you know, what's motivating those projects, what's motivating those actions. Mm. And because I know that experience of not being part of meaningful change,
mm-hmm.
it then helps me see it.
Mm.
And know how to ask the right question. I'm like, well, so in my situation, it was like, well, is the person you're appointing to do this embedded in your organization?
Mm.
Are you giving them enough time to do the work you're wanting them to do? Or are you, you know, compensating them for the fact that they're going to be your poster girl or poster boy,
mm-hmm.
poster person?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are you, when you, especially I think when around like marketing of stuff, we're so quick to be like, oh, we need to get representation visually.
Mm-hmm.
But are those people being exploited for that? You know, what's the consent process there, mm-hmm. for that? When you have the visible representation in your marketing, is that then reflected in the actual delivery of the thing,
mm-hmm.
whatever that is? Or are they just on the posters?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you start to unpack, well, is anything actually happening here?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I stand by what I said before, but I think I'm thinking of it in deeper ways now. You know, are people enabling, so if there has been like a shift in who's involved in a project,
yeah.
or if it's a project specifically targeted at a group, yeah. are they being enabled to thrive? Are they actually being given autonomy?
Mm.
Is it being driven by them, or are they just a consultative group that you don't actually take anything they do and go on?
Yeah.
What's the role? What is their role? What's their power? And are you actually willing to listen? Or are you just pretending to listen? Like, are you actually going to change anything off the back of what they tell you?
Mm-hmm.
If they turn around and say, actually, you've got a racist institution that's really not safe and we don't feel valued, or, you know, that what we're doing is, we don't feel respected in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Are they actually going to change off the back of that, or are they just going to shut it down? That's the difference.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on the podcast and able to share your experience and moving through these spaces, and as well giving as a different way of looking at how your journey can develop,
mm-hmm.
and develop and end up in a place to where you're actually thriving, and mm-hmm. and us also introducing the whole self to us, because I feel like that's such rewarding kind of just tools that I feel like I don't hear a lot about and
forget about a lot.
Even forget about a lot. So even just having this conversation with you is great.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of curious, before we wrap up and stuff, are there any like ongoing projects that you want people to keep an eye out, mm-hmm. or?
Gosh, yeah. So I've been like a lot busier now with my solo work, which has been amazing. So if you want to know when I'm gigging, I guess the best way is probably like Twitter or Instagram.
The new X.
And my handle is @diljeetb_flute. I mean, typically if you type in Diljeet and flute, it'll come up. The joys of, that's one of the perks of having a less common name,
right,
in exactly. this part of the world. It's like one of the perks. One of the few, well, yeah, no, it's a perk. And yeah, my website, diljeetbatchel.com. So that's where my website's probably where most of the professional stuff sits.
And yeah.
I've got stuff on there if people want to book me for anything, things.
Yeah.
Consultancy, that kind of thing. Commissions, that sort of stuff's on there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not very active on X actually anymore, but still lurking.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, Instagram seems to be where it's at the moment.
All right. Instagram. Amazing. I mean, that's literally me. We have this conversation all the time. I'm terrible at social media. But thank you for joining us. And I as well, like, for anyone listening, we'll drop this information in our show notes, as well as link to the websites and the articles we mentioned and some of the other organizations that you mentioned. We'll definitely link those. And I mean, it's been amazing having you, and I'm super excited to see your continuous thriving. Is that a thing?
I like that. I like that. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's been so, so nice to chat to you both and meet you. And I'm sure we're going to keep talking for a lot and lots of time to come. So, yeah, thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
Amazing.